Welcome to Extra Feature Interview. Today I have a fabulous guest whose film everybody needs to see. Social media monster, director Peter John Ross is here. Welcome.
Hello.
So, this thing is insane. I don't know how else to describe when you talk to people. Like, I can't believe this.
It is positively surreal to live through it. And I'm currently living through it. He just recorded on Twitter on one of these things called a Spaces.
Oh, yeah.
15 minutes ago. 15 minutes ago, he's ranting and raving about a podcast I did just like this.
Okay. Well, that was one of my questions. So let's start there. When you do an interview about this film, do you get attacked instantly when it goes up?
Here's the thing. He is stalking my social media like a hawk 24 hours a day. I mean, usually it's within 10 to 15 minutes maximum from the time I post something to the time he's recorded audio or video or made 7 or 8 tweets about it. So, yeah. And I mean, for people that haven't seen the movie, it's basically Social Media Monster is not about me and this guy. It just happens to be the guy that had been cyber stalking me harassed a bunch of people in the city of St. Joseph, Missouri. And I decided, well, since I'm very peripheral to the story, I feel like I can be objective enough to tell the story of how this guy leveraged social media to do an incredible amount of damage to people's reputations, tried to get them fired from their jobs. He got into it with the police, the city council, and eventually the FBI. And it's just this enormous story, and it culminates to the point where he made threats to commit acts of terrorism at a nuclear facility and got away with it. He tried to tell the FBI that it was actually me that hacked his account and did it. Pretty sure they got the warrants and proved it wasn't me. And after meeting with the FBI for 2.5 hours, I wasn't arrested. So when I say in the film that the FBI said, yeah, we already checked the IPs and the cell towers and all that, we knew it wasn't you. Yeah, the proof is I walked out of there. So, it's just an insane story, and ever since I've made the documentary, the titular social media monster, he's dialed that up to 11 at this point. He is a live wire. He's threatened multiple film festivals. He's threatened most film reviewers.
Uh-oh.
And shockingly, a percentage of them have taken their reviews down, which is really sad because I can understand it completely on one hand, in that it's like, I wrote a review of a movie, I don't need this crap. And they'll delete it, going, it's like, that's the easiest way out. The problem is, they just validated a cyber terrorist who now thinks, it works. I'm going to do this every time, and then it keeps working.
Well, I can't wait he does it to me, because I'll just turn off comments.
Yeah, I mean, again, it's going to be more what the pattern is generally, he'll send you a bunch of emails or, well, the thing that just happened last night with a woman who did this really nice review of the film in writing, he sent her a bunch of emails on her website, and then he wrote a bad review of her film reviews on Facebook. And so to me, the strangest thing about this with the festivals and reviewers is, he's claiming to be furious about the documentary because it misrepresents him as someone who doesn't weaponize social media, and his way of defending himself is to weaponize social media. So he's proving that he does these things. It's like he's proving the documentary is true in trying to discredit the film. It's just the strangest thing I've ever seen in my life.
Okay, let's go more into the film now. Okay. We got the film nice. I want to go. When you first discovered this whole project, how did you feel like getting into it with Matt? I mean, this was a big undertaking of you.
So the thing was, is on an indie film site, in 2012, that is 12 years ago, I had a disagreement. It wasn't even a fight. It was just a disagreement with some guy who called himself Taylor Hanacek. Then I started getting emails from a Matthew Kane, and he was talking about stuff on that website. I'm like, wait a minute, are you the guy from that site? And then eventually, it was like 6-7 months later, I find out his actual name is Matthew Burdick. And he's just latched on to me and never let go. It is the strangest thing. In 2015, I filed for a civil stalking protection order. He just evaded service, and eventually it was dropped. I filed again in 2016, and I dropped it again. I was like, I just want this to go away. They dismissed the case. Then in 2018, what happened was is I got that phone call from a city councilman in St. Joseph, Missouri, going, hey, have you ever heard of this guy? And I'm like, oh, man, you poor people are going to be dealing with this for a while. And I just, you know, started observing and recording the stuff on Facebook, but I had no intention of making a documentary. Whenever I brought up this crazy story, so many people are like, well, you're a filmmaker. You should make a documentary about this. I'm like, ew, no, no. But the thing is, what happened in St. Joseph, Missouri was so unique, so interesting, that I was like, this actually seems like it would be a good documentary because it's not about me. My life is boring. I am one of the world's most boring humans. No one wants to see a documentary about me. But when I saw these really interesting, creative people, these characters, and kind of like the feeling of this town, it's like the spirit of kind of the Old West where Jesse James got shot and killed is kind of still in the lifeblood of the area, in a manner of speaking. And so I found the people of St. Joseph so endearing. Their unique way of standing up to this cyberbully was so interesting that I literally made the decision to make the documentary when Matthew Burdick started sending emails saying, I'm going to show up with an assault rifle.
Okay.
And bullets are going to be sprayed on the stage. And I don't know what it was, but I was like, hey, I should pack up my gear, drive 11 hours and be there when this happens and possibly get killed. And so I don't know why that made sense at the time. It's quite literally like the muse came down and appeared before me and pushed me to go. And I did. And I went and filmed the concert and I had scheduled interviews the next day. So the concert, the people in St. Joseph were having a benefit concert for the victims of Matthew Burdick. And I thought that was so funny. Like, that was such a unique way of taking all this negativity of this guy trolling and insulting and trying to get people fired for months. I thought it was such an inventive and creative and like a silly reaction, but at the same time, it's creating something positive out of all that negativity. I'm like, I want to be a part of this. And then I decided I'm going to shoot interviews the next day. And I contacted all these different people that I saw on Facebook that had been involved that half of them didn't know the other half at all.
Really?
Not at all. Like the woman from IHOP didn't know anybody else.
Oh.
The guy, Austin from the newspaper, didn't know anybody else. And so it was this very interesting thing to where, you know, none of these people, like half the people knew each other, the other half didn't know anybody else. And I had the single most profound experience I've ever had as a filmmaker, which was when we started shooting these interviews, and remember, it's just me with lights and cameras and a microphone, and I'm just talking to people, and it felt like an AA meeting. It was cathartic. They were telling me their story, and I'm like, I remember when he had said the same thing to me. And then there's people waiting to be interviewed next, and they're like, that's what I felt like. And it was like this big group sharing that lasted for like 10 or 11 hours. And it was the most cathartic experience I've ever had because we were all like, God damn it. I thought I was the only one this was happening to. And it was all of us. And it was this, I've never experienced anything like that with any product I've ever done. So The problem became that was in February of 2020. I then proceeded to spend the entire year not even looking at the documentary or the interview footage. I was trying to make a living, or that was 2019, sorry. That was February of 2019. I spent the rest of the year working. And then in February 2020, I had already tried to do the Dr. Phil show with Matthew Burdick. They saw the trailer for the documentary, which is the only thing I'd made. It's just a trailer. In late December, early January. Late December 2019, January 2020. So they saw the trailer, liked it enough that they flew me and a couple other people Burdick had targeted and harassed. They flew us out there to do an episode to confront him. They brought him in, but according to the producers and what they told us, he freaked them out so much they killed the episode mid-shoot before we got anywhere near each other. So the funny thing with that was, is I got a free vacation to California. I bumped my return flight by several days, and I hung out with friends that have moved to LA for days, and I was having the best time. And they felt so bad, they sent us to Disneyland. They sent us to Disneyland, and we even got reimbursed for the Uber ride.
Wow.
So, and then the greatest thing that happened was I had Austin Powers teeth my entire life. I flew in for the Dr. Phil show. A limousine picks me up with the guy holding the card. That's never happened to me before. The first thing they do is they take me to a Beverly Hills dentist who was working on the Sabbath. And he then was supposed to give me temporary veneers. He gave me permanent veneers.
Perfect.
And the other thing is, like, again, this is one of those strange things that for years now, Matthew keeps claiming I'm lying about that because I said I got all new teeth. When I say all new teeth, I don't mean the entire mouth. It's just the front two teeth.
I understand.
For some reason, he doesn't. He keeps claiming this never happened. And it's like, I didn't pay for these. This is just what happened. And it's just the front two teeth. That's it. But he fixed them in 48 minutes and changed my entire life in less than an hour. I send that guy a thank you every year. I send that dentist. I have his business card, and I send him a thank you every year. So it's, this experience was just fantastic to be out there. And I had my second catharsis, which was the whole time I'm there, first he fixed my teeth. Then they're treating me like gold. They're filming stuff. All the different like PAs and the cinematographer, they all want to see the trailer on my laptop while we're shooting B-roll and stuff like that. And it's like, I'm being treated with a level of respect in Hollywood I've never seen before. And it was, and I was beating myself up all day about, what have you ever done to deserve this? You know, that's what the voice in my head keeps saying. And then that night, after being awake for 20 hours, I get to the hotel room and I have the most amazing meltdown of my life. Because I kept asking myself, do you deserve this? And I actually had to say, yes, I'm not here for me. I'm here representing dozens and dozens of people that Matthew has harassed. It's because I'm doing something that wasn't selfishly for myself. That's why good things were happening. And it was this realization about how much I'd let my ego get before. And how the solution wasn't to cut myself off from people, but to actually try to be a better man, to do better by people. And that even includes Matthew, because in 2019 or early 2020, I made a new rule for myself. I will not make fun of him. I will not call him names. I will not insult him. I will not do anything, like I will not engage in anything, no matter how bad a stuff he says about me. It's like, I'm not going to return fire ever. And I've held by that the entire time. And I've encouraged other people to do the same. Now, I can't tell other people what to do. But it's like, I'm not going to be mean to him. I want to operate from a place of empathy. Because I think for somebody that lives their entire life when they're almost 50 years old, if they live their life entirely on the internet and don't really live in the real world, I think there's a, and then based on the level of narcissism he displays, I think it's very likely he's mentally ill. Although it's a question of I'm not qualified to diagnose the man. So I don't know what is wrong with him. And you can see and hear him say things that are completely cogent. And then there's other times where he's screaming and seems to be out of control. Now, I don't know if that's a performance or if he's genuinely in distress. I have no way of knowing. And there's ample evidence on the both extremities to where I don't know what's wrong with the guy. But something is wrong. Now, is it a choice he's making to be like this? Or is it truly, fully, involuntarily mental illness? And I think the answer is yes on both. Just depends on what moment you're in. It could be something like manic phases and lucid states. But again, that's not my milieu. I am in no way, shape, or form qualified to diagnose somebody.
Okay. I want to go back to the interview process.
Okay.
You knew, obviously, the band existed. So you didn't know to interview these people? That you said it was already planned. So
I had not even really talked to anybody from the band before the concert. We had a little bit of communication. The one person I talked to the most was Brian Myers, the city councilman in St. Joseph.
He seems very well-spoken.
He's fantastic. I mean, he's a pretty liberal guy, but he was really tight with every single conservative on city council because he's a good person and an even better politician in that regard, meaning he fought for what he believed in, but knew that compromise was not a dirty word. And so everybody liked him. So he was a very well-respected, well-liked person in that community. He's since moved away to Georgia.
Okay. Have you tried to meet Matthew at any time?
I hope I never meet him in person ever.
Well, you're still Dr. Phil. So that's what I was thinking. Maybe there was something after that.
Well, after the documentary, I did file for a civil stalking protection order in 2022. We did have hearings that he participated in, but it was entirely through Zoom.
Oh.
Because I think he knew that if he showed up in person, he was likely to be held in contempt of court. And probably also because he was pretty poor and couldn't make the trip. But regardless, I was granted a civil stalking protection order against him. He's violated the CSPO multiple times. He has warrants for his arrest for making violent threats against me, for violating the CSPO. And then he was also held in contempt of court later at hearings that he didn't show up to for violating the CSPO.
So they can't find him is what I'm understanding.
No, that's not the issue. The issue right now is everything with cyber crimes. And this is kind of like the real meat of the documentary Social Media Monster, which is they're all misdemeanor crimes. If he stays out of Columbus, Ohio, nothing will ever happen to him.
I get it.
Warrants don't extend past the county.
I get it. So, yeah, as long as he's smart, hopefully.
He's not dumb. I would never say that Matthew is dumb. That is one thing I could never describe him. I've said this a few other times, which is his IQ hits 185 when he feels the heat of law enforcement coming at him. When he knows he's done or said something to where there might be consequences, his intellect sharply goes up.
So how much research have you done? I mean, obviously you did research on Matthew, but I mean, you did a lot of research for the interview questions, for the IHOP case, on the newspaper.
I did a lot of hours of research. Myself and some of the co-producers and associate producers and even volunteers, we didn't put anything in the movie that wasn't quadruple confirmed. So, I mean, one of the most common refrains is that Matthew keeps saying that it's a fake documentary and it's been entirely discredited. And it's like him saying it's discredited doesn't discredit it. There's no evidence that discredits it. And in fact, here's a huge confession I'll make, which was because I had interviewed off the record multiple people in the St. Joseph Police Department, prosecutor's office. I interviewed a lot of people that didn't want to appear on camera. I interviewed a former FBI agent off the record. Now, the interesting thing about all of that is, though, they didn't want to appear on camera or legally couldn't appear on camera. But for background color, I basically confirmed everything that's said in the documentary and didn't think much of it. Well, barely a month ago, Burdick goes on Twitter and says, I have obtained the 911 recording from the IHOP incident. Now, for people listening that have never seen the documentary, everything in St. Joseph is keyed off of a bizarre incident at the IHOP in St. Joseph, Missouri. He shows up, claims that a man was beating a woman. The man and woman were in the IHOP, and they'd had a verbal, loud argument that everybody witnessed, but nobody saw the physical altercation except for Matthew. Well, Matthew is an incredibly unreliable narrator, so nobody knows if it really happened because you can't really trust anything he says without proof, and he has no proof. So he goes into the restaurant and says, and just so you know, there might have been a physical altercation between the man and woman. I'm not saying there wasn't. I'm saying we have no way of knowing because, unfortunately, he's the only witness. And he's not reliable at all. He has no credibility, as becomes really evident because he goes in and asks these three kind of bigger guys, can you help me protect this woman? And they're like, we saw them fight. It's none of our business and it's none of yours. He then called them pussies, which got them to stand up. They all went outside and puffed their chest, but nothing really happened. But Burdick at some point pulls out his iPhone and starts recording it. And it's just him taunting these guys, trying to provoke them into a fight.
Correct.
And he says insane things about himself. He says insane things to them. It gets really weird. And that's the impetus of the entire documentary. That's kind of like the fulcrum point of the whole story. So the weirdness is, I'm going to confess, I never obtained the police reports from that night. I didn't feel I needed it because everything had been confirmed by every single witness. Every single person I could find that was at the IHOP that night confirmed the story. I'd spoken to the police department, but not those two officers. Or I spoke to one of the two officers. And they confirmed everything. So I didn't think I needed the police reports. Well, last month, in 2024, Burdick said, I obtained the 911 call and the police reports, and it has discredited the entire documentary. So I got curious, and I'm like, well, I better get a hold of these then. So I asked one of the band members to go pick up copies. We submitted the official Sunshine request. It's a state statute about, it's like FOIA. It's like Freedom of Information Act, but it's at the state level. There's a Sunshine Act law. He went and filled it all out, got the copies. It cost us $7.50 in copies. And then I'm on a job. I'm directing a podcast for a live stream on YouTube. And I start getting the Facebook messages going, I picked up the documents. Then it's, oh my God, these are incredible. Then it's like, oh my God, here's the first two pages. Then it's like, here's the next set of pages. I'm like, God, I can't wait for this podcast to be over because I want to find out. He's not saying what they say. He's just saying they're incredible. And I'm like, does that mean good? Does that mean bad? What does it mean? So after the live stream, I went to a pizza joint and I was almost asked to leave because I started laughing so hard when I was reading these police reports, because these police reports not only do not exonerate him and confirm everything in the film, it shows we went way easier on him than what happened in reality. I mean, the police report is like, this person, Matthew Burdick, drove his car, his BMW, almost into back of our squad car, driving erratically. Then they were like, he randomly said he was a millionaire filmmaker from Hollywood six times apropos to nothing. You know, it's stuff like that. And it's like, and then he's also saying when they asked, he claimed he'd been punched in the face. They're like, well, we want to take a photo. And he refused to allow a photo to be taken. And then he said, you're trying to prevent me from getting health care. I'm going to sue the department, and then left. It's like, that is so much worse than what's in the documentary. It's like, it's just insane. And so, yeah. And I mean, When we get the formal release on Amazon at the end of the month, that's when I'm going to release the police reports publicly. And what I can't figure out is, why was he saying this exonerated him and discredited the film when it's the exact opposite? I think my theory is, since he thought no one's going to look this up, he could lie about it and get away with it.
Makes sense. Okay. Next question, because you, Matt's paper, I did want to get into that a bit. You do show me a copy of it. Does it still exist? Do you still read it?
Kind of. I mean, there's an archive website. It was never a newspaper by any legal definition whatsoever. Like, it doesn't exist as a newspaper. It's just a WordPress blog.
Oh, okay.
The newspaper is not really a newspaper. It's called the Daily Independent Journal. The website, dailyindependentjournal.com, still exists. And anyone who sees it will see that's not a real newspaper. I mean, it might look like it on the surface. Read any one of the articles. Count the number of grammatical mistakes, number one. And number two, the content is so – it's just blogs. It's like somebody writing a blog that looks like a newspaper. But there's nothing that resembles journalism anywhere on it, never has been. So, yeah, the newspaper still exists, but it's not a newspaper. It's just a WordPress blog.
Okay.
And anybody can still see it right now. And if you really want to see it, use the Wayback Machine, also called the Internet Archive. Look at what he posted in 2018, and you're really going to find it. It's a blog where he just defamed people, defamed like the fire chief for correcting one of his, you know, actual factual errors. It's him writing blogs about Brian Myers being racist when he's anything but. It's just nonsense like that. It's not journalism by any definition. And the other thing about it, someone says in the movie, which is he never sold ads.
Yeah, weird.
So he never attempted to make money with it. But he also never attempted journalism either. So I guess it all worked out correctly in the end, I guess.
Did you ever attempt to find the guy funding him? Alex, I think his name was.
I have just recorded a few months ago a 2.5-hour Zoom interview with Alex.
Oh!
I had found him while we were editing. We spoke on the phone for a couple hours. And I got quotes for him for the documentary, which are in the documentary in writing. He did not want to appear on camera. He did appear on a Zoom recording for me for the sequel, sidequel, whatever we're calling the next chapter.
Interesting. Because he's the person I wanted to meet.
It is one of the most fascinating parts of the story because I was asked specifically not to talk about the dollar amounts, but it was a lot of money he lost giving it to Matthew that never came back. It was numbers that would horrify any human being.
Okay. You've gone to see the concert. You haven't met these people yet. And you want to interview them. So how did you go about setting that all up? I mean, you have a bar location. Is that
what was Brian Myers owned a bar.
Okay.
And it's closed on Sundays. So what happened was, is Saturday night's the concert. I'm there. I film the concert with two cameras, film a bunch of stuff. And then the next morning, I set up at the bar, and I have interviews scheduled from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. And people are just coming in one at a time. And there's overlap. And I'm just sitting there interviewing, asking questions. And it was one of the strangest experiences. Like I said, it was so cathartic to share. Because I would share my stories in between stuff, too. When the camera's not rolling, I'm, like, talking just as much as they are when the camera's not recording. But when they're recording, I've been doing documentaries in testimonial videos at that point for 19 years. And I'd been trained by some of the best. There was one guy that when I switched over, I was a licensed broker with a Series 6 and Series 7 trader's license, and left that world to become a dirt poor filmmaker.
I was like, for sure, that was not a good choice.
It was the best choice I've ever made in my life.
I know you're happier.
Here's the thing is, you know what I used to say back then? I've never been this poor and I've never been this happy.
Fair enough. I accept that.
The thing is I'm not poor now. I'm not rich, but I don't care. I get to do what I love for a living. You know how few people get to ever say that?
Yes.
And so I'm one of the luckiest people that ever lived getting to do what I do. And I was even able to buy a house doing what I love. So to me, it was the thing where the first guy I worked with, there was a local videographer named Mike Tavares, African-American, small business owner, and he was with the old linear tape-to-tape video. He wanted to get into computer-based editing, which is the only thing I knew how to do. So he's like, I have an offer for you. I have this four-month-long video project doing interviews, and I want you to build my edit system for me. I'll pay you for it, and I'll pay you to be my editor, teach me how to edit on the computer, and then we'll part ways as friends. I then worked with them for 7 years. We got along so well that we didn't stop working together until he moved away. He's somebody I consider to be like my big brother. He's one of my greatest mentors, and watching him work with the documentary format, even though they weren't technically documentaries, they were more testimonial promotional videos where you interview people. Seeing how he can take some of the world's most boring humans and figure out how to get them excited and sound alive on camera. And his instinct of when to zoom in when someone was saying something really emotional, he just had this incredible magical ability to know when and how long it was going to take them to say something really meaningful and just slowly move in as they're getting deeply emotional about something. And it was just raw talent to watch him work. And I learned as much as I could from him. And I learned to do that myself, but not at his level. To this day, I don't think I'm at his level. I mean, Mike is a genius. Mike had unbridled talent, and it was an honor to work with them for all those years. And Burdick has called him and texted him and harassed him.
I do want to bring attention to your mom, because she has the best quote: a nomination is not a win. And you cut to her. And I got to say, I broke up so hard when you cut to your mom. Made my whole day.
She just passed away in January.
I know. You told me. But I want to say that was awesome work on your part. It made me laugh so hard.
Two things about that, which is number one, we did three takes and she said, do you want more? I can do more. And I was like, I think we got it. She's like, I got more to say about this. I'm like, that was plenty.
That was perfect.
And it's actually very true. She would say that at every family event. We're like, oh, I heard you got an Emmy nomination. She'd run into the room and say, a nomination is not a win.
It's awesome.
Anything.
My wife would say the same thing to me.
So my mom, God bless her. I mean, I've never known a human being that had nothing bad to say about another person her entire life. In every day of my life, never once did she say a negative thing about another person. I've never known anything like that. And so when Burdick found out on social media that my mom died, he started saying some of the most heinous and horrible shit.
Why? I just don't.
He desperately wants to hurt my feelings. And what hurts me most is that my dad had to hear it. My sisters, my nephews, my niece, they all had to hear it. And instead of being angry, it makes me more empathetic. It's like, what makes a person hurt like that to want to do that to another person? Like, what did he need a hug? What does Matthew need to stop him from being like this? And if he is a genuine psychopath or sociopath, which I have no way of knowing if he is, but if he's a psychopath or sociopath, he's never going to get fixed. He's just going to keep doing this to people till the day he dies. And what I find sad is, like, he doesn't seem to care about what he leaves in his wake.
I did, after watching the documentary, made a note, what does Matt really do? Like, how does he get his money now?
I mean, what he's been doing for the last 2 years is he's been doing handyman ads on Craigslist. And then he's literally living on ramen noodles, living in his Ford Explorer. But what he did just in the past 2 weeks, he raised $2,600 to buy a new car that I don't think he bought a new car. So he's been e-begging. Like, one of the things that's pretty common that I hear from people, that he'll contact people, even people he barely knows, and he'll hit them up for, can you Venmo me $5 or $6 just so I can eat today? And he'll do that almost like it's his job. At least that's what it appears like from the outside.
So that's,
I mean, if he has some other source of income, I have to say, honestly, I don't know what it is. But it does not appear like he has a regular job of any kind. I don't think he could hold a regular job. If he's doing handyman repairs, we were able to track it for a little while, and it helped us in getting him served for the civil signing protection order, but he's hiding that as he's on the West Coast being a handyman. So I don't know. Honestly, it just appears like e-begging. And what's really shocking in the last couple of weeks that he just revealed, Facebook, from which he has multiple permanent bans, is paying him money to make for engagement on his Facebook posts.
Oh, God.
I want to figure out, how in the hell do you go from permanent bans to getting paid by Facebook? And even worse, Facebook is still not liable for anything he says or does that harasses people on Facebook.
Well, you do get into that. I'm just going to leave that out. You do get into that in the film. So people, it is there. You have to look for it.
Well, I'm talking about currently. I
want to touch on Matt's footage. Did you just, okay? You have a lot of it. So I can't see him being very happy about you having his footage, but you do have a lot of it. Is it just that, public
statement? I will disagree with that. I will vehemently disagree with you on that. I think he pretends to not be happy, but here's the truth of it. Like I said, in 2019, I'd shot the interviews but didn't edit it. One of the reasons I didn't want to edit it is I don't have any footage of Matt.
Right.
There's nothing to represent his side of the story.
No, none.
So when he found out that I was making the documentary, he started creating content to refute what he thought was in the documentary. And I'm like, I can use that. I can use that. And then he's putting on these insane hats. Like, he has all these different weird hats that he's wearing. He's, you know, getting more and more disheveled, which matches. He's starting to look like how he sounds.
Yes.
And I was like, you know, I did say this once, like, you know, it's like, this is exactly what we need. And it was. But the thing is, he also knew that. And then it became a thing to where, and I didn't want to abuse this, but it would be like, well, I don't have anything when he talks about Austin. So I'd say, I would just go to my social media. It's like, well, that Austin Gocher. And the next thing you know, hey, I got a 45-minute on Austin Gocher. And so it was like, well, at the same time, it's like, I did that once or twice, and I'm like, no, I'm not going to keep doing that. That feels manipulative. And so I'm like, I'm not going to do that anymore. That's not right to do it that way. If he wants to rant and rave about something on his own, he then, as that started to happen, you could see that I'm adding it to the movie. And I'm even saying, it's like, he's giving us material for the movie. And he was. He knows it's being used. He verbally says all the time, I know it's going to get you. I know this is going to be used in the documentary. And it's like, so you're consenting to me using the footage. But then we approached him when we had our first big offer, which we couldn't get. We approached him about, we're going to give you between $3,000 and $4,000 to sign a release form to use your footage. And he said, I want $500,000. And it was so obtuse and so far from reality. It's like, this is not the kind of movie that makes $500,000. Nonetheless, you getting paid that for this crappy looking footage, you know, it's like, be real. And no, he insisted on the $500,000. And so negotiations quickly came to an end. And that was before the civil stalking protection order was filed.
Okay. I only have a couple. Last thing I have is fun questions for you, because I think we've covered the film mostly. Yeah. You got to watch it, people. I don't want to get into it because there's just too much cool stuff to discover.
So, yeah, hit me with your questions.
If these ones are easier. Because your first time on the show, your favorite film?
Blade Runner, the original. Not the theatrical. I do prefer the final cut.
Okay. Well, there's like 12 cuts of that film, so.
My favorite, though, technically, would be this one fan edit that took everything and compiled it in sequential order. But it's not in 4K, and it doesn't have surround sound, so I don't really watch it that often. But that would, if somebody had been able to put that out in 4K with the surround sound, that would be my favorite. But as it is, Ridley's final cut is pretty solid.
Your favorite documentary?
American Movie.
Okay.
American Movie was a documentary about a horror filmmaker in Wisconsin, Mark Borchard, who I eventually did meet. I got to meet Mark. His partner in the movie, his buddy, has recently passed away. But I met the filmmakers when they came to Columbus to screen it at the Drexel Theater. So I got to meet the director and the producer. This is in the year like 2000. That was an amazing experience getting to meet them and watch the film with them on a 35 mil print. And it was just a fantastic movie. And I think it's a movie that everybody thinks they're making fun of the guy, but it's, to me, it's clear that they loved him.
Last question. Most anticipated film of 2024.
Deadpool and Wolverine. I'm a Marvel nerd. I can't hide from it.
That's fine. Tell everybody where they can find your work, please.
Most of my stuff can be found through my my main user moniker. My avatar is Sonny Boo, S-O-N-N-Y-B-O-O. That's my YouTube channel that has everything on the documentary. The documentary is socialmediadoc.com for documentary. That's the best place to find. If you look for Sonny Boo, you're going to find me. You're also likely going to find a bunch of weird stuff that Matthew posts because he's an SEO champion when it comes to defaming people. That's but I do him. Currently have a defamation lawsuit against Matthew Burdick LLC at the moment.
Well, I know I'm getting something for this interview, so I'll look forward to it because I won't answer him because I don't care.
The best thing you can do is just ignore him.
I will.
For some weird reason, he keeps going on about how he wants equal time and he can't believe anybody watched the documentary and doesn't want to reach out and become his friend or contact him and have a conversation.
No, thanks.
So let me ask you, why wouldn't you want to contact him?
Because this is not what I do. He doesn't have a film. If he made a film, I'd be more than happy to do it. He talks about making a film numerous times. I've yet to see it. So if he knows anything about my site, I need a film first. I don't care if it's 8 minutes, 20 minutes, 3 hours. I will watch it. So why am I not reaching out to him? Because I don't really care. Because he doesn't have what I need.
Well, that's the thing is,
Matthew, you can come on.
He made a 71-minute, he calls it a documentary, but I don't consider it one. But if you consider it a documentary, if he reaches out to you to review his movie Blame Reagan,
I will do it.
By all means, talk to him about it. Watch it. Talk to him about it. I'm not trying to prevent him from doing things. Like, I don't consider it a film. It's not. It's a 71-minute vlog.
To do this, Matthew, I'm right here. Extrafeatures@gmail.com. I'm not hard to find. You need to know how to use social media. You can find me easily.
What he'll want to do is he'll want to talk about my documentary more than his own.
Well, if he wants to, that's fine, but he'll just waste his time.
Yeah, I think the biggest thing, what he's done so far is he thinks he's nitpicked little weird details that he thinks are inaccurate, but like he'll talk about, I have evidence of this, but he'll never be able to present it to you.
Well, then,
believe me, one of the cinematographers and the co-producer, he's a journalist, he vetted the hell out of the movie, viewing it from that perspective of what can we, is there anything in this film that can't be proven? And he thoroughly vetted it for us. And so there's nothing there, but it would be interesting. I'm willing to, when he sees that offer, he's going to take you up on it.
Okay, well, that's fine.
I hope he does. I, if he wants to promote his YouTube video, Blame Reagan to you,
more by all means. Yeah, I'm here. I don't have, I let everybody have equal time. I don't, they want to send it
there
to
it
me.
Is.
Time, I say thank you. And that's all I have to say about that. And you, thank you for your time and have a great day.
You too. Thank you so much for letting me be on.